Campus FM presents Classic Texts, produced by Vicky Spiteri, presented by Margaret Ajus.
Hello and welcome to Classic Texts. As in previous weeks, we will go through a light-footed presentation of a Victorian work of literature. I'm Margaret Ajus, and this week's choice is Gulliver's Travels, Jonathan Swift's fascinating allegorical tale of one man's mental and spiritual journey as he voyages to strange, far-flung lands. On his travels, he encounters bizarre creatures who, on closer observation, are perhaps not that different from himself. Written as a satirical comedy, Gulliver's Travels was intended to vex the world rather than divert it, which Swift apparently did, as Thackeray found the last voyage in the book filthy in word, filthy in thought, furious, raging, and obscene. The most savage satire ever written on human society, Gulliver's Travels is now widely read as a children's tale. The hero, Lemuel Gulliver, is a ship's surgeon who in the first part is shipwrecked on the island of Lilliput, where he finds a replica of human society in miniature. Gulliver is tied up by hundreds of tiny human creatures and ingeniously conveyed to the capital city to meet the emperor. Fascinated by the giant, the little people flock to see Gulliver, while the emperor and ministers of state concern themselves with how to feed and care for such a giant. They grant him his liberty, dependent on various conditions, and in response to an appeal from the emperor, he agrees to help the Lilliputians fight their enemies of the island of Blefuscu, who are amassing their fleet for an invasion. Gulliver wades across to this island and pulls the enemy fleet ashore to Lilliput, so putting an end to the threatened invasion and gaining honours for himself among the little people. But the emperor wants more assistance from Gulliver to make the whole of Blefuscu subject to Lilliput rule. Gulliver's refusal to be an instrument of bringing a free and brave people into slavery casts him into disfavour. When he learns of his impending charge, he leaves for Blefuscu and eventually returns home. The voyage to Bromding Nag forms the second part of Gulliver's adventures. This time, he finds himself in a land peopled by giants, where even rats, wasps, and dogs are of frightening proportions. Taken in by a farmer, Gulliver is made to work for his board by travelling to market towns and performing all day for an incredulous audience. He is tenderly cared for by 9-year-old Glum Dalclitch, the farmer's daughter, who stays with Gulliver when he is sold to the Queen for 1,000 gold pieces. A special little bedroom is made for him where he can be safe from most hazards, although he suffers several accidents which alarm Glum Dalclitch and make Gulliver feel both frightened and ridiculous. He spends many hours with the King, who is curious to discover more about the lifestyle and government of Gulliver's homeland. The more the King learns, the more horrified he becomes. Gulliver considers the king politically naive, but is nevertheless discomforted by his damning pronouncement on the human race. The third of Gulliver's travels takes him eastward to Laputa, a mysterious flying island inhabited by strange people lost in intense speculations. Interested only in music and mathematics, the Laputians have no time for practicalities such as building good houses. Gulliver tires of being confined to the king's floating island and is dropped down to Balnibarbi, where he's shown wild schemes devised by professors in the Academy of Projectors, while all around the land lies wasted and people starve. Gulliver moves on to Blugdubdrib, the island for sorcerers, where he calls up his favourite heroes from the dead. On another island called Lugnag, he is enraptured to hear of a race of immortals, but they prove to be a horrifying vision of everlasting senility. The voyage to the Hohenems is Gulliver's last adventure. The victim of a mutiny, he set ashore on a strange land where he encounters the Ahous, a disgusting species of animal which bears a frightening resemblance to the human form. The land is populated by the Hohenems, a noble race of horses who gradually appear to Gulliver to be the perfection of nature. Gulliver tries to explain his own worlds, but he is met with perplexity, for the Hohenems have no language for lying, treachery, and evil. They can only believe Gulliver has said the thing which is not. Gulliver hopes for nothing more than to spend his life among these gentle beings whom he has learned to love and respect, but his journeys are not yet over. Gulliver's Travels is primarily a satire on the politics of Swift's era. It is also a novel, concerned with the hero's variety of experiences and his consequent development. Filled with contemporary political references, which may strike a chord in substance, if not in detail, the book is as vivid and alive as ever, thanks to Swift's comic artistry and his timeless theme of human corruption. The book is not so much a critique of humanity as a whole, as an attack on those who abuse their positions of power and influence. Swift hated institutions, but loved the individual. I hate and detest that animal called man, although I heartily love John, Peter, Thomas, and so forth. The individual in Gulliver's Travels is Gulliver himself. His careful and methodical account of the different worlds he explores forms the basis of the story. Of greater significance is his place as a human being in each of these worlds. In this sense, Gulliver is an allegorical figure. His experiences encompass the human experience, and what he observes has meaning for all of us. The irony of the tale lies in Gulliver's inability to recognize the wider significance of his various encounters. Swift uses him as a device to expose the political cruelty and corruption of 18th century society. The story of Gulliver's adventures in Lilliput is easily the most delightful of the four journeys. The detail and wit describing Gulliver's stay among the tiny Lilliputians have made this section an enduring children's classic. A Voyage to Lilliput is also a political history incorporating the reigns of Queen Anne and King George I and the rocky careers of several leading statesmen. Gulliver's observation of the Emperor's ingratitude is a direct comment on King George's greed. Gulliver as a giant is the moral superior of the Lilliputians. In his voyage to Bromding Nag, the situation is reversed. The King of Brobding Nag is very much Swift's ideal monarch. He spends many hours extracting the truth from Gulliver about the history and culture of Europe, and can only conclude that Gulliver's fellow humans must be the most pernicious race of little odious vermin that nature ever suffered to crawl upon the surface of the earth. Gulliver offers the formula for gunpowder to the king and only makes matters worse. The king expresses horror at the thought of so much deliberate destruction and suggests that whoever could make 2 ears of corn or 2 blades of grass to grow upon a spot of ground where only one grew before would do more essential service to his country than the whole race of politicians put together. Brobding Nag, with its stable system of government and benign ruler, is a utopian state which England would do well to imitate. Book 3 of Gulliver's Voyages contrasts sharply with this ideal. The state of affairs in Laputa and Balnibarbi is so dreadful as to serve as an allegory of the worst excesses of 18th century folly and corruption. Gulliver becomes a shadowy figure in this section, as Swift's denunciation of bad government and wild schemes comes to the fore. In the final book, Gulliver receives his biggest surprise. He has stumbled into a society of truly rational beings whose existence reduces him to the level of animal. It is a stroke of Swift's brilliance that he elevates animals to fill the place which humans believe is rightfully theirs. The Hoi Hin Hins are horses, and at the same time perfect creatures of order, while the human Yahoos are filthy creatures of instinct. The allegory of man's essential baseness and amorality is complete. Gulliver becomes unable to say the thing which is not, and virtually incapable of living among his own kind again. One of Swift's most important arguments in Gulliver's Travels is that human beings are capable of reason, but that this does not therefore mean that they are rational. The book is filled with descriptions of human degeneracy and abuses of the power of reason. The wonderful world of Lilliput is simply a microcosm of society, and is riddled with just the same vices. Brobdingnag has its fair share of ugliness, and is simply the human condition magnified. The islands of the third book are steeped in an atmosphere of dereliction and death, the result of willfully misguided human endeavour. It is in describing the Hoy Hin hymns that Swift's point is made most forcibly. The Yahoos possess no power of reason. They are simply bestial, and therefore not culpable. Hoy Hin hymns, on the other hand, are endowed by nature with a general disposition to all virtues. Somewhere in between is Gulliver. His explanation of the causes and art of war at home confirms the Hoy Hin hymn master in his belief that Gulliver and his people, instead of reason, were only possessed of some quality fitted to increase our natural vices. Gulliver is forced to accept that he is a Yahoo, after all. He differs from them only in wearing clothes and possessing a thin veneer of civilization. The ability to reason, which is supposedly the crucial difference between humans and animals, is not enough to keep him from vice. Jonathan Swift was born of impoverished English parents in Dublin in November 1667. His father died several months before the birth of his only son, leaving his young wife with an 18-month-old daughter and very little money. While still a baby, Jonathan was abducted by his nurse, who, visiting an ill relative, just stayed. It took nearly 3 years for Mrs. Swift to track them down across the Irish Sea. When he was 6, Jonathan was sent to Kilkenny College, the leading Anglican school in Ireland. For 8 years, his intellectual precocity was developed through a rigorous classical education. He later recalled it as a period of happiness unaffected by the confinement 10 hours a day to nouns and verbs, the terror of the rod, the bloody noses and broken shins. Swift was an average high-spirited undergraduate. He missed lectures, neglected his studies, was accused of starting tumults, and gained his degree at 18, only by special dispensation. Carer choices in those days were limited, and personal progress often depended on finding a generous or influential patron. Swift entered the service of a retired diplomat, where he had time to indulge his passion for reading and writing, and was able to study for a master's. Sir William, who was both employer and surrogate father, encouraged him, sharing the youth's idealism and nurturing his growing interest in politics, while symptoms of his lifelong illness, Meniere's disease, started emerging. After 5 years at Moor Park, Swift felt restless for wider achievement. He waited impatiently for the help his mentor had promised, but there was a blazing row since the old man was desperate to retain Swift's services. In January 1695, Swift took halty orders and was ordained in Dublin and appointed priest to the small, lonely parish of Kilroot near Belfast. But the following year, he returned to Moor Park at Sir William's invitation, remaining there until the latter's death in 1699. Swift's first book, A Tale of the Tub, a satirical masterpiece, appeared in 1705 and was an instant sellout. The book was published anonymously, like many of Swift's works, but suspicions were enough to blight his church career by the ironic aspersions against Christianity in this and later books. Swift was a man of contradiction. Passionate but iron-controlled, he liked women, yet was repelled by female sexuality. He despised extravagance, but spent freely on good food and drink. He lived healthily, yet had a morbid interest in sewage. He was occasionally snobbish and self-pitying, yet constantly generous. At least one-third of his income went to the poor of Ireland. He saved probably hundreds from starving to death. He became absorbed in politics, and by 1707 he was the envoy of the Irish Church, in close contact with court and government circles in London. Swift's writings included political essays, pamphlets, and miscellaneous verse, and these brought him many new admirers. As a leading political writer, Swift's two main achievements were to add his voice successfully to ending the 21-year war with France, and to persuade the Tories that the correct power balance between monarchs, lords, and commons was vital for stable democracy. This was a tenet which he expounded in weekly articles for the Examiner between November 1710 and June 1711. He developed a friendship with Esther Van Homere, daughter of his landlady and of a former Lord Mayor. Esther fell hopelessly in love with Swift, and although partly detailed in his poem Cadenus and Vanessa, his pseudonyms for the two of them, the full extent of their relationship remains unknown. Meanwhile, Swift's reward for political services was the position of Dean at St. Patrick's Cathedral, becoming an excellent manager of revenues and a popular preacher. Furious at the poverty around him, he tried shocking people into action. He preached passive resistance and then outright defiance against English imperialism, and there were a number of bids to silence the Dean. Gulliver's travels took Swift 4 years to write. He brought the manuscript to London in March 1726, and calling himself Richard Simpson, for safety, arranged for its publication in return for $200. Fearing prosecution, the publisher toned down parts of the text. Swift's bitterness about the amendments was tempered by the book's resounding success. Stella, his friend, whom he adopted when she was a child, died in January 1728 after a long and painful illness. Reports that she and Swift were married during her last days remain unproved. He consoled himself with more writing, further charitable acts, and visits to his many friends. He suffered a stroke in 1742, died in 1745, aged 77, and buried in St. Patrick's Cathedral. We have come to the end of another program in the series Classic Texts. Credits go to the Great Writers Magazine for the script and to Selene Buhajar for her technical expertise. I'm Margaret Arjous. Join us again next week for another program in the series.
You have just listened to Classic Texts, produced by Vicky Spiteri, presented by Margaret Arjous.